Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 131, recorded August 4th, 2011. Water cooling's back. Should you care?
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. And by squarespace.com. The fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off your new account for 6 months, go to squarespace.com and use offer code TWITCH8.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware. I'm Patrick Norton, joined as always by the man, the myth, and the moving target, Ryan Shrout, who I believe is at QuakeCon in Dallas, Texas.
I am, Patrick. Always. I like to stay one step ahead of any of and all authorities that might be looking for me. But every week we get on the show and then you tell them where I'm at and it completely defeats the purpose.
Oh, they don't believe you're actually where I'm saying you are because, I mean, actually, I got to say, you know what? You are in Dallas and that is a huge, everything is bigger in Texas. This is your conference room that you paid like $8 for the evening for? Come on, pan the camera.
Yeah, wicked cheap for like a whole weekend. We're here in Dallas covering QuakeCon 2011. It's like the nation's largest LAN party, 2,200 seats, BYOC, I believe, which is pretty impressive. And actually, everything's running very smoothly this year. They got everybody in. Internet is working. All the connections, they're not having any problems. About an hour ago, somebody showed me a speed test they did on their computer, and they were getting 86 megabits down and like 29 megabits up. From a random computer in the BYOC. So that's kind of interesting. Of course, we have our hardware workshop on Saturday, which is pretty cool.
Tell us about the hardware workshop, Ryan.
This is really a two-hour window with which the QuakeCon organizers and stuff let us have where we just think of ways to give away as much hardware as possible. We have well in excess of $30,000 in hardware that we're going to be giving away in this two-hour period. Everything from two gaming systems to we've got some never-before-seen graphics cards, actually two different ones that have never been before seen that we're going to give away, a pair of each of those. We've got a lot of interesting stuff. NVIDIA is going to be on hand to show off some neat things. Lots of raffle and prizes and stuff like that. This is our chance to give back to the community. We give back a lot to the volunteers who make this LAN party and event happen too. So it's a lot of fun. If you're in the Dallas area, definitely come by. It's 3:30 Central Time, Saturday, August 6th. Show up about 3 or so to make sure you get in. One of the first 1,000 people, that's the limit for one of the contests. But anybody who else shows up will get entered in for some of the prizes at the very least. So if you can't be there in person, go to pcper.com/workshop and we're going to live stream it. So you'll at least be able to see other people winning prizes, I guess. A lot of people keep asking us to figure out a way to give out prizes on the live stream. And we haven't really come up with a well-organized...
You're pretty generous with the prizes. I think people just have to pay more attention to Twitch and pcper.com if they want more toys. I got to ask one question. Will you be gaming this weekend? And what name should people look for if they want to know that they have personally fragged Ryan Shrout?
You know, the likelihood of me finding time to sit down and play a game is pretty unlikely. Like we got here this afternoon, been organizing stuff. Tomorrow we have we're going to organize, and we've got an hour long session with John Carmack tomorrow. We're going to interview him, ask him his opinions and what he thinks about the future of hardware and stuff like that. That will be really cool. And then after that, we immediately go into starting to finish up planning and set up for our event on Saturday. So it's possible we'll get on there. I'll make it very obvious. If I do play, it'll just be Ryan Shrout. Well, I'm lazy on Twitter and all that kind of stuff, so I'll be lazy with my handle as well.
Well, there you have it. Twitch at twit.tv, that is the email address you want to send us a question, a tip, an idea you want to hear about. By the way, I want to thank everyone who brought Mego into my life last week, which is a miserable, epic 6.5 ending at 5 in the morning fail on installation. I'm going to return to that later on tonight to see if I can get it to behave. Nice. But you actually wanted to thank everybody, and for those who don't know, Amigo is essentially an open source operating system designed to be very, very thin and light. So they've got a version of it that's directed towards in-vehicle systems, infotainment systems. They have an SDK for smart TVs, and of course a netbook version, which I'm very excited about because I haven't touched my Dell Mini 10 in months, and having something to do with that would be cool. You wanted to thank all the emails on notebooks using FireWire and Express Card.
Yeah, that was kind of my thing from last year or last week, I guess, was complaining about the only option that I could find. It was readily available using Sandy Bridge, and FireWire and Express Card was the MacBook Pro. It was $2,500. And I had lots of emails come in with suggestions from Lenovo, HP, and Dell. All of which, I guess it makes sense, focused around the desktop versions of those models, right? Or not the desktop, the business models of those machines. So they were still relatively expensive, anywhere from $1,600 to, you know, $2,000, less than the MacBook Pro, but offering much of the same features, which was really cool. So we're still debating whether or not we're going to go with that versus the dedicated desktop route and all that kind of stuff. So we've got a lot of links and information with that. And so that is one of the ways that Patrick and I could take advantage of this awesome community of hardware enthusiasts as well. That, you know, as much as we pretend and like to tell everybody how much we know, the masses of people who listen to us know so much more, and they can look at so much more, you know, content and filter it down and find the best results for everybody, not just for me, but for everybody. So it was pretty cool.
It's very cool. And the audiences are amazing, whether you're talking about Techzilla or PCPer.com or Twitch.
Yep.
It's kind of an interesting week for news. Last week was kind of a slow news week. This week, a bunch of news stories, but something I wanted to start out with. Tom's Hardware did an interesting story called A Peek into SSD Reliability, where they it's interesting where they talk about everything from RMA, return rates, the sort of large-scale adoption or what's happened to ISPs or server farms are doing large-scale adoption of SSDs. I wish Alan was online right now. You should totally, like, drag him into the conversation.
We've talked a little bit about it, yeah.
What did he think of the article? Because it seemed like, to me, it basically seemed like the warning was that SSDs are amazing, SSD statistics are amazing, but back up your data regularly.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much what we came away with. I mean, the article is actually well written and worded. There's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of questions we have about some of the kind of final results. If you go to the last page, there are seven bullet points where they're like, what does this really mean for SSDs? And some of those are kind of, yeah, you expect that type of stuff. MTBF tells you nothing about reliability. That's pretty much been the case for SSDs and hard drives, you know, forever, right? It's a mean, right? It's not specific to any, you know, your models, it's also, your specific drives, anything like that.
It's unfortunately, a lot of people see mean time between failure and they think, oh my goodness, my hard drive's going to last 300,000 hours of use. And it's like, you know, the annualized failure rate is higher than what the manufacturers claim. Drives do not have a tendency to fail during the first year of use. Failure rates steadily increase with age.
And that's interesting. That number three is interesting to me. I know the next one, the next several interesting to you, that's actually more interesting to me, that they do not have a tendency to fail during the first year. My gut reaction would have been otherwise to that. I mean, well, I guess that's just when you're most apt to notice it or complain about it as well. So
I think you get like, I think there's a more bitter and more, the closer to purchase that something dies, the more bitter and angry and likely someone is to start my SSD manufacturer sucks.com on the internet. But the, you know, with anything that involves transistors, generally speaking, if it survives the first 48 hours, it's probably going to run until there's a horrible power spike or somebody replaces it with something newer and shinier and faster. But I would be curious what is if there is a single point of failure over time. Like, if failure rates are steadily increasing with age, does that mean, you know, are there thermal issues? Are transistors burning out? Is because, you know, circuits tend, you know what I mean? Like, integrated circuits tend to run forever unless they have a horrible heat or power glitch.
Unless they don't.
That melts it out, yeah.
you know, it's one of those things that I think one of the possibilities that Alan and I kind of discussed on that also was because of the popularity of SSDs, the profitability of SSDs, the fact that they are the hot new item, that it's possible we're actually seeing a reduction in quality control, right? Where they're like, well, this is going into enthusiast market, and maybe they're stretching boundaries a little bit further than they should in order to get that extra bump of speed to outpace their competitor, or to get that extra little bit of yield in order to lower the price a little bit to beat their competitor on that front. Right. I think that's also possible, and it kind of speaks to the youth of the industry still. I mean, keep in mind, SSDs for consumers are still only 3 years old, right? If we look at it in that term of how much we talk about them, how much they have grown and changed in that three-year time is really substantial, even though when it comes right down to it, we're still talking about just flash memory. But I think there's a lot that goes into it. This article was really interesting. One of the things that I'm very confused about that Alan and I still want to talk about and figure out what they're getting this point from is number six on there. The failure of one drive in an array increases the likelihood of another drive failure, which seems very odd.
No, actually, that makes sense to me, because every time a drive fails, you increase the amount of traffic going between the other drives and the RAIDs as they resurrect parity data in a RAID 5. So to me, that makes a weird kind of sense, because you know, you go from six drives to five drives doing a whole bunch of traffic to, you know, to reconstitute the data, to use a highly sophisticated term that probably would make Alan wince. but in a weird way, that actually makes sense to me. It also could be that, you know, if there's one particular drive in your RAID array that is weaker than the others, you know, whatever causes it to fail, you know, then may cause the other drives to fail in succession. But I think it may be a simple factor of just that there's a whole bunch more reads and writes. One of the things we probably should point out too is that, you know, wearing the drives out through excessive copying to and from the drive, like very early in the article, they were kind of like, you don't really need to worry about that. You shouldn't have to worry about the number of PE cycles that your SSD can sustain. The previous generation of consumer-oriented SSDs used 3x MLC NAND, generally rated for 5,000 cycles. In other words, you could write to and then erase data 5,000 times before the NAND cells started losing their ability to retain data. Continuing that, the average desktop user writes at most 10 gigs a day. It would take about 31 years to completely wear a drive out. With 25 nanometer NAND, this figure drops down to 18 years. Of course, we're oversimplifying a complex calculation. Sure. You know, write amplification, compression, and garbage collection can affect those estimates. But overall, there is no reason you should have to monitor write endurance like some sort of doomsday clock on your desktops. So, it's definitely, if you're an SSD user or if you're thinking about buying an SSD, I would highly recommend it as a thoughtful and thought-provoking article about solid-state drives.
Yeah, definitely give it a look.
Big water cooling news this week. You want to start with PNY or Zotac?
I guess we could talk. We'll start with the PNY. This was, I guess, this is also giving away to one of the surprise contests or one of the surprise giveaways at the workshop on Saturday is a pair of these PNY Accelerate XLR8. Is the kind of the brand there, liquid cooled GTX 580 cards. And this is kind of interesting. It's not the first water cooled graphics cards. It's not the first water cooled GTX 580 or anything like that. But what's interesting about this is that it is the first completely self-contained unit that we've had in house. And actually, we worked with PNY really closely trying to get these cards for the workshop. They're going to be included in the system build contest, which I'm kind of worried is going to make it complicated because nobody's ever built these with these before. So there's a lot of possibility for user error in the installation, but we'll see how that goes. What's interesting is that they're releasing two models of this. So you'll see a GTX 580 with a 120-millimeter radiator and fan combination. That just, you know, you plug in the graphics card, you put the radiator on the back of your case. Very similarly to how we have the self-contained CPU water coolers like from Corsair and Acetek and all those other guys, right? Very similar setup to that, only with a GPU. They're also delivering a combo unit that is a double-width radiator, two fans, cools the GTX 580, and it has a water block for your CPU. So that's the one you can see in the pictures on our website there. Those are the ones we actually got in and have started playing with. So it's kind of, now you can cool your GPU and you cool your CPU through the self-contained water block. The benefits are lower noise, you know, better temperatures. Again, you're not talking like super high performance water cooling here. This is more of convenience water cooling, but it works very well. And it's kind of interesting. The first two units that they produced, period, we got and are giving away Saturday. Like they shipped them to us in this weird egg crate configuration because they don't even have a retail packaging even started for them yet. They don't even have the forms for it and that kind of deal. So it was kind of a struggle to get this. And then we had to learn how to install them in order to make sure we had all the parts and could do it for the system build contest. So we got all that working. So it's pretty cool. Prices are going to be, let's see, what did they say? Like $640 for the combo unit, but that includes
graphics. That's not quite card, right? Emotionally. So, that just sounds expensive.
It does.
It sounds like an amazing card, but I'm like, wow, I've built several PCs for less than that.
So you're getting a GTX 580, which is probably around $430 to $450. You're getting it water cooled, and then you're getting a water cooler for your CPU, which might cost you $60 to $80. So there's still definitely a surcharge and upcharge for what you're getting there, but it's not super dramatic, right? But it's pretty cool. We're interested to, once we give these two away to some lucky participants in the workshop on Saturday, to actually getting another one in-house to actually spend some time with and play with and review and that kind of stuff too. So it'll be interesting. And then that combined with the Zotac announcement kind of makes it an interesting time for liquid cooling, as you mentioned. They're releasing a very similar product. We haven't seen these in-house yet, but we do have some like renderings and a news post on the website. What's interesting about their option is that it's single slot. It removes the dual slot configuration from the card, which is kind of nice.
You're basically routing the cooling outside of the chassis, which may or may not. No, actually, I take it back. It is inside.
Stays inside still.
The first time I saw that, I kept thinking like, wow, they're routing the water cooling lines on the outside, but those are internal. It's going to be interesting to see how well the length of those water cooling cables coming out of the Zotac are going to play with some of the larger systems people might be using. But it's kind of funny. I was laughing when I was going through the rundown earlier. I almost took a picture last night of the literally like a they have this central computers or local computer store, and there's one down in Santa Clara down near where Lloyd Case lives that is one of the best outfitted computer shops. It's like Newegg, except it's a physical building in somebody's neighborhood.
Nice.
One up here in San Francisco is not quite that good, but it's still, you know, it's like the best selection of cables I've ever seen outside of Monoprice. But I bring this up because they literally had like a 6 foot wide shelf, 4.5 feet high, stuffed with water cooling systems from Corsair and other manufacturers. And it was like, whoa, this is like freaking 2000 all over again. But it's funny, right? Because you got, you know, Zotac's offering this as an option on GTX 580, 570, GTX 480s to get the Omni water cooling upgrade kit. And then Hard OCP was all over the HRO2 Macho, which is a horribly named but incredibly effective air cooler that's coming from Thermalright. And they were basically the difference is 5.7 degrees Celsius at an overclocked CPU versus the best water cooling, the top rated water cooler versus 5 degrees Celsius at idle when set to high behind the top rated water cooler and being considerably quieter in the process. I was also laughing because I posted this up on Google Plus and it was highly amusing watching the reactions. Because I forgot just exactly how loyal people are to their preferred choice of air cooler for their CPU. And B, how many people like haven't been inside a PC in several years and were like, oh my God, that's bigger than the engine in my car. And it's like, what are you driving, dude? A smart?
Yeah, nice.
But it is a good time for cooling and overclocking. I'm also kind of, you know, It'll be interesting to see also what this ends up selling for retail. But they're looking at about like a $40 retail for this car, for air cooler, which is, it's actually ridiculous given how inexpensive it is. I was also laughing. I forgot to bring them in with me, but while I was in my trip to buy a $6 USB cable to Central Computer that turned out to a $160 exercise in lack of personal restraint. I also picked up, I'm doing a quiet PC build for Texilla, and I ended up picking up multiple fans, including a 200 millimeter low rev fan. So it'll be fun to see what I can do with case temperatures.
Nice.
With the, like these fans that are claiming to have like, you know, 8 to 11 decibels of noise, which of course comes back to the nightmare of trying to measure anything under about 40 dB, which is just about impossible with consumer grade audio measurement hardware. Battlefield 3 alpha benchmarks. How accurate, how relatively useful are alpha benchmarks going to be compared to the shipping version?
So I guess that was the obligatory like grain of salt pet thing. They're not incredibly useful. They're not necessarily indicative of final gameplay, but they're still interesting to look at because it gives you an idea. And then there's two possibilities once you know where your kind of card performs there. Either B, they're going to tweak it more and your card will perform better. Or the other option is that they'll increase the detail levels when the game is actually released, and your car will perform not as well. And then they'll depend on NVIDIA and AMD on the driver side to kind of make improvements. It looks like the numbers from gamegpu.ru, which is the website that broke whatever NDAs were in place for all this, said that for smooth experience at 1080p, you should anticipate having a GTX 480 or Radeon 5830 as your minimum. And it looks like a GTX 560 or a Radeon 6950 if you want to hover around 60 frames per second. They did notice things like SLI and Crossfire weren't properly implemented yet. So dual GPU, you know, wasn't running, you know, faster than a single GPU, that type of thing, which will obviously be addressed both by NVIDIA and AMD and the driver teams or the development teams for the game too. But I know I'm taking advantage of the technology and push new graphics cards. We want them to push them, but I don't think anybody wants a repeat of what happened with the original Crysis. We want it to be more controlled, but we still want to see things push forward. We're here at QuakeCon 2011. We get the first hands-on for the public with Rage, id Software's Rage title. Hopefully they'll be talking about Doom 4 a little bit. Maybe they did at the keynote. Did they talk about Doom 4 at all? No, not really. Yeah, so you know, those are the types of games
can
we want to see.
Can I get a copy of Rage?
Not yet. I don't know when the release. I think September. They're playing on Xboxes and PCs in the demo area.
You mentioned it's funny you mentioned Crysis because one of the things I was thinking about in the summary here is on the CPU side of things, while no Sandy Ridge processors were tested, it looks like performance will hit a bit of a plateau around 6-core Phenom 2s, upper core i5, and lower core i7 parts, which means to me that this is most definitely GPU U-bound. If hitting a upper core i5, lower core i7 means you're not getting any more performance out of it. Have they literally made it a bit of a GPU buster? I mean, it just sounds that way.
I hope not. I don't think so. I think the CPU plateaus we're talking about are improving the CPU above that won't improve performance. I still think improving the GPU and performance above that will still increase what settings you can run and all that type of stuff. It's games still aren't catching up with CPU multithreading as fast as they should.
Right.
But GPUs are one of those things that will scale much better for as long as we can go with it, I guess. We did have another news post. I think last week we talked a little bit about it. This is real quick. Ivy Bridge and X79 chipset. We talked a little bit about how they were kind of removing features and that type of stuff. It looks like if you go to our story at PCPro.com, which was sourced from a report from VRZone, looks like we got more kind of clarification on what the X79 chipset is actually losing. It kind of confirms what we knew before. More interesting is that the Ivy Bridge processor will be locked at 100 megahertz base clock, which means overclocking capabilities could be more limited than they were with Sandy Bridge and more limited than they were with Clarkdale and that kind of stuff, which is obviously for enthusiasts, that type of stuff is bad news. But we always have to see how these things turn out. I think one of the complications is that I think it's using much of the same memory architecture as Sandy Bridge E, which is a quad-channel memory controller. And so it introduces a whole new level of complication in the bus timings and that kind of thing. So it might be a requirement, or Intel is claiming that it's a requirement for this generation of processors. But it's something we'll just have to see how it turns out apparently as close as November. So
we've got a dog pile of questions and a couple more news stories we want to get to. Should we take a quick break to thank one of our sponsors?
Absolutely. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Netflix. Netflix streams thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to you instantly, which means you save time, money, and hassle. No more driving or trying to find a movie rental store in your neighborhood. There are lots of easy ways to instantly access the streaming movies and TV shows with Netflix. You can watch them on Mac or PC or iPad with the new iPad app. You can watch on your iPhone and some Android phones too. If you have gaming consoles like an Xbox 360, PlayStation 3, Nintendo Wii, you can watch Netflix right on your TV through those as well. And if you're not a gamer, you can still watch Netflix on your TV with an Apple TV or a Roku box, those types of inexpensive HDPC alternatives, if you will. With Netflix, you can watch movies and TV shows instantly using any of these devices, and you can begin watching a movie or show on one device and then finish on a different one, which is really nice. It's kind of like your basic version of a multi-room DVR, if you will. Whichever way you choose to access Netflix, you can watch as many movies and TV shows as you want, anytime you want, which is nice. The unlimited capability of that is great. And you can cancel anytime if you just aren't satisfied with the product in any way. But as a user of Netflix streaming, this is something that definitely gets a lot of use at our house, and I don't think we'll be canceling anytime soon. You can try Netflix today for 30 days free. Go to netflix.com/twit, T-W-I-T. Be sure to use that URL when you sign up for the free trial, netflix.com/twit. We thank Netflix for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware and hope you enjoy watching instantly with Netflix.
Thank you, Netflix. And thank you, Netflix, for actually allowing me to watch an entire season of... let's not get into it. We should probably do OCC technology. We've seen a couple of these recently, PCI Express-based solid-state drives. This is mostly targeted towards the enterprise, but the Z-Drive R4 PCI Express solid-state storage systems, because it can't just be a drive if you want to charge the big dollars. But what's
systems,
going on with...
Yes.
Systems, the virtualized controller architecture, VCA 2.0, what is that actually bringing in terms of performance?
So Alan's sitting next to me, so he'll correct me if I'm getting any of this wrong. But VCA was actually first introduced with the R3.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That was released at Computex, and this is kind of their version of, it's getting around some of the complications when you have RAID behind RAID controllers, right? So you've got these Z-Drive R3s and R4s and even the R2s and that kind of stuff are multiple controllers RAIDed together to create larger, faster arrays. The issue was you couldn't pass things like trim support. It also caused issues with being able to daisy chain things. It didn't cause any boot issues necessarily, but this is another iteration of it. So the first version it came out with fixed a lot of those things, which is great. You could pass trim. Windows had the capability to pass trim commands through that because it's logic. It's not like a controller that we're all used to seeing. Like, it's not a RAID controller from Marvel or something like that. You know, this is... Right. Not necessarily custom logic from OCZ, but something that they're definitely prioritizing, developing, and keeping in-house as much as possible. And this is what they're hoping will allow them to get into those much more profitable enterprise locations, which is kind of cool. The SuperScale controller, I guess, is something that they're combining with VCA to... let's see what they're saying here. Oh, it allows you to, so this is definitely enterprise level stuff. OCZ's intelligent complex command queuing structures, unique queue balancing algorithms. They're claiming superior performance aggregation to higher throughput, reduced burden on the host CPU. These are all things, you know, that are really important. They're talking R4 is capable of transferring up to 2,800 megabytes per second, which is 2.8 gigabytes per second. And completing over 500,000 IO operations per second, so IOPS, and apparently if you have a dual SuperScale controller card, it can go up to 5,600 megabytes per second and 1.2 million IOPS. So those are pretty impressive numbers that these cards have the potential to release. I don't know, have they talked about any kind of release dates or anything yet on them? No, it's maybe this year, maybe not. But, the R3s are really just kind of starting to surface in the market. Right. You know, they were first showed off in June at Computex, over in Taiwan. So this is something, you know, the next generation of product they just kind of wanted to get out there and rolling and that kind of stuff. So
tease. If you're a hardware nerd, by the way, go look at the pictures on the article and start counting the number of SandForce controllers and the size of the freaking capacitors. All those orange squares on the cards you're looking at in that picture when you blow it up to high res are big. Those are just big, big capacitors for a PCI Express board. And I'm counting like at least four SandForce controllers on one card. And there's just a lot of hardware on that board. One of the big stories coming out at CES this year that everybody's really, really, really excited about was Intel's Ultrabook form factor. Mm-hmm. Which I like to describe as a netbook without the suck. Not that there's anything wrong with the Atom CPU, but having recently spent most of an evening with an Atom CPU, okay. I love fast machines, which is why I'm really in love with my MacBook Air. Unfortunately, generally speaking, PC platforms or Windows platforms have to charge less for the same amount of hardware to be widely accepted by the PC community. But basically, it's like that's the UX1, the UX21 you saw flashing up there is a 1.1 kilogram, so it's 2.3 pounds, give or take, of brushed aluminum, fully kitted out with a new style lithium battery, 1.7 meters thick, nice instant on technology. And that's what we were all excited about. It's a good looking Windows 7 kind of notebook. But it looks like the CULV parts, the processors are going to be expensive, extremely expensive. So we're looking at this being like 1,000. The cost of the components you need to meet Intel specifications are around $1,000. And that's just the cost of the components. I don't think that's the cost of the components plus adding in enough cash to assemble the machine, much less make a profit off of it, which is definitely putting that right in MacBook Air territory. So that's going to be really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those. This was the platform, the Ultrabook. Was going to compete with the MacBook Air. It was going to bring those form factors, allow designers to bring those types of form factors to the PC market and the Windows market. And according to the DigiTimes report, you know, the issue is actually physically on price, which makes you wonder if Apple, you know, this is one of the benefits Apple has with all their cash reserves, right? They can buy stuff way out in advance at a lower price, at higher bulk, because they know they're going to sell through a certain number of units, whereas all these other companies are taking a chance on a risk on a new form factor for the PC market with lots of competition out there. And so, you know, you're very quickly, looks like you're meeting or exceeding the price of a MacBook Air for a Windows-based system of similar specifications, which is not the PC strong suit, right? It's competing on price and functionality, not the other way around type of thing. You know, it always has to be a little bit lower if you want to get people interested and say, well, you don't want to pay for that high price stuff but when the hardware is the same. Well, in this case, it looks like it would be possibly the reverse, where the hardware is actually cheaper on the Apple side. So that's kind of unique, kind of interesting, disappointing if you're a Windows fan, kind of like rewarding, I don't know if I say rewarding, but vindicating if you've always been an Apple fan and that kind of stuff. And maybe this is what they've been fighting towards for all these years, is that kind of control over pricing and control over the infrastructure of all those components. So,
well, it'll be interesting because one of the things the article points out is that all the components are designed to be soldered on a single PCB. And I think part of the reason why Intel is trying to charge such a premium for this above and beyond the parts cost to Intel is that essentially, if I'm reading everything right, it's basically the vendor gets a board like this, and then they basically connect the keyboard, you know, and the mouse cables and, you know, the power cable into it. There's no subsets of modules, which also means you've got one really cool failure point for your notebook. The motherboard fails, everything else fails, and vice versa. Which brings us to our first email question. Twitch@twitch.tv is the email address. We love your questions. Fire them out to us. Hunter's got an unusual question about a design system. You want me to read this one? You want to read this one? Go for it. I was having fun actually researching this one on the Autodesk website, which is a place I've driven by many times, but I haven't used any of their products with.
I don't have any personal experience with them either, and I did the same thing. I think I was in the middle of Arkansas when I was looking up answers to this question, ironically. So Hunter asks, first of all, I want to say that he loves our show, keeps me up to date without spending hours reading reviews. Thank you for that, Hunter. Now for the question, I would be building a computer for my friend, but she's using software that I'm not familiar with, and I don't know what components to focus on. She designs kitchens and uses 2020 and Revit, RVIT. Both of these are supposedly 3D rendering. I plan on getting her RAID 1 so she won't lose her stuff, and I was going to get her a lower and i5 Sandy Bridge with a $200 GPU. She says that she wants to be future-proof, but she doesn't want to spend very little money, or she doesn't want to spend very much money. I gave her an $1,100 build list, and she didn't seem very happy. I'd love either confirmation that I'm buying the right parts or suggestion for better hardware tailored to her needs. Thanks, guys. Your show is awesome. So I had never heard of either of these applications, to be perfectly honest with you. So I went and looked up Revit.
And it seems like you did as well.
So
I used to use some applications that are similar to this for cross-platform benchmarking back in the dark old NT days, which is a version of Windows from a long time ago. Revit's, there's these really amazing applications that engineers and architects use to design buildings. And when they really get outrageous, when you basically create a model of a building. So picture the Empire State Building or a hospital or a prison or somebody's house or an offshore oil rig. And imagine every single part in that, basically a 3D virtualized version of that part that they can move, they can roll, they can scan around, they can do walkthroughs, they can render stuff out. They can. One of the big things in architecture these days is creating 3D renders and walking the client through them. Literally right down to every single screw, nail, whatever structural component, and some of these applications allow you to do structural testing in the sense of experimenting with materials and failure rates based on conditions. It's really amazing stuff. It almost makes video editing look like a joke in terms of something that taxes your system. And what gets really crazy is usually this stuff is run. There's a central set of files that are really, really, really seriously backed up at a central server. And you literally copy the latest version of it down to your desktop to create a local cache version of it, and work on that. And so they're looking at first of all, I'd say make sure you're speccing a 64-bit operating system for this. Autodesk recommends a Core i5 with 8 gigabytes of RAM for basic usage. That's what they're like. That's the entry level. I think it's probably an honest entry level. Then they say a quad core i7 or AMD equivalent, a 2 gigabyte GPU, and 16 gigabytes of RAM for their quote large and complex models performance build. Basically, that says more cores and more memory and more GPU equals better performance. Now, if your friend is an architect who works with smaller houses, basically less individual elements to be rendered, then, she might not need a particularly high-powered system. I would also say that future-proof and cheap very rarely go together. You want a house to last 1,000 years, you build with the best materials. You want to get 3 to 4 right. years out of a computer and not want to kick yourself every time you're seeing it rendering on somebody else's machine. You're going to want to go towards the high end of the configuration. I'd say skip the RAID 1, schedule regular backups to an external USB drive and set her up to do automatic backups to Carbonite or another online backup service. I would say at least a Core i5. I would see if anybody's running one of the 6-core AMD parts, since those are pretty slick. If more threads accelerate this, you might want to try getting six cores in there instead of 4. I would say 8 gigabytes of RAM, and there's a pretty long list of recommended video cards on the link that Hunter put in there. And I would say start out with one of the inexpensive video cards. Tell your friend to turn off shadowing and some of the other features. And there's several websites out there that talk about basically settings you can change inside of Revit so that you don't want to stab yourself in the face while you're trying to fix something on a building.
Those are good settings to look into.
Yeah. Well, like one of the simple ones is like turning off shadowing, right? Because you turn off there's a name for the pictures that architects draw when you're looking at the outside of building, elevations. And elevations are basically very realistic. So, but turning off certain settings can make for a leap in performance. But I think if you get a Core i5 Sandy Bridge, a fast CPU or SSD, back it up to it. Skip the RAID 1. I just don't even bother. Anything that's going to kill one hard drive is probably going to kill both, which is my sense of paranoia. Get a Core i5, 8 gigabytes of RAM. Yeah. Make sure there's a motherboard that you can drop another 2 8-gigabyte sticks into if your friend decides she wants to. Give her a performance path, that allows you to drop in like a faster CPU as they get cheaper and more RAM as it gets cheaper, or she decides that she wants it. And that would give you kind of an upgrade path in a year or two where you could add in a CPU, a GPU, and additional RAM. Because it's you know, I future-proofed spending very little money. They don't go together,
yeah.
Especially when you're talking about a professional tool. This is a write-off. This is something the accountant's going to, you know, basically you can write off. If it's a freelancer, they can write it off against their wages. If it's somebody who's working for a cheap architecture firm that doesn't properly equip their employees, then that's an entirely different bag of weasels, and I feel sorry for you, in which case, definitely go with it.
Indeed.
Core i5 is pretty amazing, and 8 gigabytes of RAM is a good place to start. And not that expensive.
No. Good for us, bad for the memory guys. Before we go on to the rest of our emails, let's jump in here and thank the second of today's podcast sponsors. That would be Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog. Now, if you've never heard of Squarespace.com, they're like an everything you need type of service. They have an easy-to-use user interface for creating and managing a website or blog. It's optimized for both beginners and CSS experts, so if you want to get into the code and change things manually, you can absolutely do that, but if you don't want to do that, you can go as hands-off as you possibly want. There are hundreds of design templates to choose from, and you can customize any of the designs to fit your need, even very easily with this drag-and-drop interface. It's really pretty nice. They have iPhone and iPad apps for updating your blog on the go, online resources, and a special support team to give you personal help 24 hours, 7 days a week. The all-inclusive service includes several modules to help you build your website, like a blog module, includes import and export support for WordPress, Blogger, Movable Type, TypePad. So if you already have data and a blog that you've maybe tried on those platforms, you can import that data and you'll be ready to go. It has a form builder so you can collect email addresses and other information from your site visitors. It has a Flickr photo display. You can choose thumbnail or slideshow views. Social media buttons, the website to Facebook and Twitter and those types of things, Google Maps, and a lot more. It also has website tracking, so you know how many times your site is viewed, and a built-in search engine optimizer. People you want to this website, maybe a buddy want to, but you want to have different logins. It has complete support for permission access handling, cloud architecture for speed and site stability. You never have to worry about your site going down because it gets a lot of traffic. Obviously, that kind of defeats the whole purpose of having a website. If when people want to view it, they can't go there. So we very much recommend using Squarespace for all of your website needs. Build it, host it, and update at any time. For your free trial, go to squarespace.com and sign up for a free account. No credit cards needed. Just try it out and start building your website. Then, when you decide to purchase it, use offer code TWICH8 and get 10% off for 6 months. That's TWICH8. 10% off for 6 months at squarespace.com. And again, the offer code is TWICH8. And we thank Squarespace for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware.
Woohoo! We got a question about Newegg alternatives. I'm going to read this one and let you answer it, especially since I just rolled right by it in the in the Google Docs. So now I go to Uma Thurman's store. Let me just start that up again. Ryan says, so now I go to Newegg, my preferred online computer retailer, to check up on the prices of said graphics card, only to discover that Newegg is no longer carrying it. So what retailer can I trust when items go out of stock without any hope of restocking on Newegg? Also, I'd prefer to stick with the XFX brand card I originally bought. I like symmetry. I want to make sure I purchase a new unopened card. No telling what's been done to a card once someone has had their mitts on it. Thanks for taking the time to either read or skim my letter. You guys rock. Keep it up, Ryan. I'm just going to say real quick, there's nothing wrong with Amazon and there's nothing wrong with Tiger PC, who is also CompUSA. Tiger PC, I should say Tiger Direct bought the rights to CompUSA.com. I've had very good luck with both of those. Amazon plus Prime equals free shipping above and beyond their you know, arguments with the state of California right now. Should he worry so much about getting another XFX card or XFX still producing cards?
You know, XFX is definitely still making cards, and I think you could still be able to find the one he was looking for. I cut out that first part of the question. Right. It was just basically describing the issue. I think it was like a 5870 or 5850 right. or something like that. You could definitely still find those. You don't have to pick the same brand. If you get a 5850 with 1 gig of memory, if that's what you have, or one with 2 gigs of memory, whatever it is, it's going to work, right? I understand you kind of want symmetry in there, but keep in mind that the difference between manufacturers on these cards – mm-hmm. very often is very little. So, you know, if you want to do that, that's fine. But I wouldn't sacrifice the platform. I wouldn't say, well, I couldn't find an XFX card, so I'm not going to bother doing this project. Definitely don't do that. It's you know, get a reference one if you can. Like I said, make reference on Sapphire or anybody else that makes that same card, and you might even be able to get it at a cheaper price too. And yeah, Amazon, Tiger Direct, ZipFly. The issue is Newegg has the best searching and kind of filtering capabilities. Right. Amazon has like the worst filtering capabilities for like XFX PC components, that type of stuff.
Well, it looks like there's at least, I was going to say, there's at least two vendors that are carrying the XFX Radeon 5850. Or no, I take that back. It's one vendor. And they say they have 20 plus available. So that's, they have them in stock. New, brand new, unopened, $294.99. Which seems a little high, but one of the problems is as products are end of life, they become just about impossible to find. Although I don't think that's particularly the case for this.
Right.
But yeah, you know, it's so funny because correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like the majority of the circuitry is pretty much what is handed to the GPU vendors by AMD or NVIDIA.
For the majority of the time, it absolutely is. So, I mean, it's going to meet the same standards. So
Luke, Luke is looking for a memory upgrade. He says, I have a question. I'm looking into getting more memory for my gaming PC. My motherboard, which is an Asus P6X58DE, sports triple channel memory. I currently have 4 gigabytes dual channel DDR1333 memory. Will I see a performance increase when I switch to triple channel memory? Keep up the great work and love the show. Man.
So I don't think he'll... He starts out, the question was, he's looking at getting more memory for his gaming PC.
Right.
He has 4 gigs, which is two gigabyte DIMMs, essentially right. A dual channel configuration, a triple channel capable memory controller. The easiest way he can add memory to his system is to get another 2 gigabyte DIMM with very similar specs, plug it in, you go from 4 to 6, you have thus increased your available memory to the gaming machine. I don't know if you're going to see noticeable performance increases with it. I guess part of the question could be, is should I bother going to 6 or should I just get 2 4s and go to 8? I would say if you have a triple channel capable memory controller, you should always be using all of the controllers. It just seems to make the most sense to me, right? You've got this capability in there. Fill them out. That's why they sell 2 DIMM kits and 3 DIMM kits.
That's why they put them there.
And why they're going to sell 4 DIMM kits when the Sandy Bridge E processors are released later this year. So, I mean, it's there for a reason. I don't know. He doesn't really specify what he's trying to get more performance from, gaming or multitasking, those types of things. But I think that by far the cheapest, easiest route he could do is install another 2 gigabyte module. Now you're up to 6 gigs of memory. That's 50% increase, and you're improving your channel count by 50%. That seems like a no-brainer.
There you have it, people. Nice for other applications. Do you want to read Dave's awesome hypothetical question about a hypothetical issue?
So Dave has a hypothetical issue. He wants to ask a hypothetical question about, suppose my CPU blew up. Could I reuse my motherboard after I removed the hypothetical ashes from the socket? Well, should I take it as a chance to hypothetically upgrade my 2-year-old computer? The warranty is out on the hypothetical busted CPU, so I'd have to buy a new one if my CPU did hypothetically blow up. So hypothetically, I would say, I don't know. He says blow up. He doesn't really say. If the processor just stopped working, maybe try replacing the processor. If smoke came out of the computer and you think it only came out of the processor, I would almost inevitably toss the motherboard as well. It's one of those things where it's almost impossible to know which specific component caused that issue. And it could be a power supply. Right. It could be the motherboard. It could be the processor. Maybe a graphics card, but that's like way out there type of thing. But, you know, it's one of those things that did it damage other parts. So if there are score marks, if there's burn marks, if there's issues of ashes or melting on your processor, I would personally use this as an opportunity to do the upgrade on his 2-year-old computer. if you're cash strapped, I don't think, I hate to say this, because you could, if you buy a new processor, you install it on a motherboard that has an issue, you could kill that new processor as well. But I think the chances of that are fairly low, but not impossible either. So it depends on what your budget is and how flexible you are and that type of thing. If you kind of think, well, you know, buying a new processor versus buying a new processor and a $130 motherboard isn't really going to kill me this month or, you know, for the next few months, that type of thing, I would probably go that route. I don't know if you have any other. That's just, I don't like it when things catch on fire in my computer. I tend to want to throw it all out because I don't want it to burn anything else.
I mean, when AMD was still doing unprotected chips on the top of their processors, I was one of the first person to discover, certainly on television, how easy it was to fracture that CPU and destroy it. Yeah, I have three of those that I keep meaning to turn into, since you're in Dallas, a hat band for my cowboy hat. Kind of like one of the rattlesnake ones, only with a bunch of dead AMD processors on it.
I like that. That's nice.
That was an expensive year for me. Actually, one of them was me. One of them was a thermal because somebody was trying to overclock my system without warning me. And I don't want to talk about the other one because I'm still bitter. But not an AMD. It's somebody else who touched one of my machines. But the problem is, and I think you made it pretty clear, is that if you don't know what killed the CPU, then, and it's really hard to kill a CPU these days. They're armored. They're basically underneath metal. They have thermal circuitry that causes them to shut down. And if things get too hot, it takes a lot of work to kill something. That usually means there's been something, some sort of, you know, if too much electricity gets into the chip, that can fry it. The electricity comes through the motherboard and is regulated by the motherboard. So, you know, I think you nailed it. If you have the money, replace the motherboard along with the CPU. If you don't have the money, replace the CPU, and hopefully it turns out to have been a glitch in the CPU and not the motherboard.
Right.
I think that's probably about all you can say on that. I know you wanted to answer Stillian's question about a GPU issue because you said you had a hard out. So we've got about 5 minutes to wrap everything up on that.
We can do that. This is an email. He says he recently purchased a Gigabyte GTX 560 Ti OC and decided to use my old ASUS GTX 260 as a dedicated physics card. Added both cards to the motherboard and noticed that they are dangerously close to each other. There's maybe 1 to 1.5 centimeter space between them. I powered the computer on and ran a few games like Bad Company 2 and Arkham Asylum, and everything looks and runs fine. I try Crysis 2 with its DX11 patch and high-res texture pack, and my monitor suddenly switches off after playing a bit. Tried it twice and switched off both times at different stage. The computer is non-responsive and he has to restart. Is this a power issue? He has a 650-watt thermal take power supply. Is it a temperature issue? I know the cooler on my Gigabyte 560 sucks air in and pushes it through the chip and out the back. With the 260 sitting right in front of it, what I'm guessing is that it is sucking in all of the hot air created by the back of the GeForce GTX 260. I did keep an eye on my temperature using SpeedFan and couldn't see anything rising above 60 to 65 degrees Celsius. Any ideas? I'm really worried about frying my card. Thank you very much for your time. This is the potential issues that involve or that arise when you have multi-GPU configurations, whether you're doing SLI or dedicated cards, or even if you're just doing multiple monitors, those types of things. My first suggestion would be, he mentions his motherboard here. Is there another PCI Express slot that you can move it to? Right? I mean, they don't have to be next to each other necessarily. For better performance or anything like that. I'm looking at the board here. Nope, no other options. Sorry about that. So, they do have to be right next to each other. You got two dual slot cards. I'm tempted to say, so a 560 Ti, you know, those new patches for Crysis 2, the high-res packs, those types of things, those are very new. Those are very difficult on the system. It is kind of possible. I would use a different monitoring program. Go download GPU-Z. Go download MSI Afterburner. You don't have to have an MSI video card to do that. You could download the ASUS GPU Tweak. See what those GPU temperature monitoring applications are telling you. I'm not real familiar with using speed fan for GPU temperature monitoring. That's not what we use in house or anything like that. And if it's only getting to 65, heat is not the issue. Those GPUs are very robust. I mean, we run GPUs in the 80s and 90s all the time. I wouldn't recommend it, but we do it, and we don't have a lot of problems. So if you're the highest you're actually seeing is 65, heat's not the issue. Power supply, maybe-ish. 650 watts should be good for those two cards if you're not overclocking them and overclocking your processor and that type of thing. You know, it could just be a game issue, right? Because he says it doesn't have a bad company too, which is also very, very power hungry in terms of GPU horsepower and that kind of stuff. So, I don't know. Wait a little bit, see if the drivers change, release some new drivers for that card. I don't know how Crysis 2 actually uses PhysX exactly. So, based on his specs and that kind of stuff, I'm not too worried about it. And people put cards next to each other like that all the time. And as long as you don't have like a incredibly hot ambient temperature in your room or something like that, I wouldn't think it would be a problem. And the 560 Ti is a fairly cool running card. It's a low process tech. It's a smaller iteration. 260, not as efficient, but again, I don't think it should be a huge difficult issue all right. for this.
Yeah. I think the downside of running motherboard monitor or whatever your tool of choice, whether it came from the motherboard manufacturer or you download it somewhere, is if you don't have a lot of experience looking at a lot of thermals on motherboards or GPUs, or if you don't have time to sort of research it, and it can be really hard to find out the appropriate thermals for a CPU or a GPU, you can get panicked really right. quickly.
Yeah, exactly.
Because the other thing is especially GPUs are operating at what would have been considered a ridiculous temperature just a few years ago. And that's just part of the normal idling thermal envelope. And you're sitting there like, oh, my goodness. Oh, wait. Okay. This is perfectly normal. You know, it's like, you know, Intel CPUs, you know, you don't particularly want them operating at 100 degrees Celsius or even at 99 degrees Celsius, but they don't start self-protecting by rolling back the internal clock speed until they get to 100 degrees Celsius. So the core gets real hot before it starts to protect itself, which means that the engineers tend to be conservative, which means, you know, you can probably go much higher than that without damaging the part. But yeah, go forth and do not panic. And I'll let you know what I find out playing around with my giant collection of high volume, low or high air volume, low audio volume fans over the next couple of weeks.
Nice.
You have to get out of the room before they kick you out, and I actually have to drive to Petaluma. Sadly, traffic
after the show. Yes.
After the show. Well, yeah, there's a baseball situation down the street from me. I don't know who the Giants are playing this week, but everybody in Northern California was trying to get into California. So,
nice.
PC Per, we obviously have more coming up and giveaways coming up at QuakeCon. Where is the if you are in the Dallas-Fort Worth area or willing to drive there from, you know, however far away you can drive, where should right. people be at QuakeCon to get
the
free
Hilton,
stuff?
Hilton Anatole is the hotel that we are at, big convention area as well. August 6th, 3:30 p.m., the main stage area. I believe it's branded the Alienware stage, Alienware main stage. It seats like 3,000 people. If we get that many, I'll be really impressed, so I highly encourage it, but I don't think we will. But we're giving away like $30,000 worth of hardware and goodies and T-shirts, like lots and lots of T-shirts and that kind of stuff as well, contributed everywhere. So if you're in the area, please stop by. It's going to be a lot of fun, and it's just great to be able to give back to everybody, or not everybody, but a lot of people. Let's put it that way. Anything interesting coming up on Techzilla this week?
We're going to finish abusing the IOSafe rugged hard drive tomorrow, which will involve a 7,000-pound truck, diesel fuel, various and sundry other fluids, and some epic drops. So if you want to find out whether or not this thing – I've been told that it is not fireproof. Mm-hmm. And they really don't want me to shoot it with my 308. That would be 7.62 by 51 NATO if you're that kind of cat.
Yeah, don't do that.
They're like, they're like, we shot it with shotguns, but shotguns are different from bullets. I'm like, I understand. Basically starting on a quiet PC build and taking a look at Pioneer's App Radio next week, which is a really,
cool.
really interesting device for patching your iPhone or your iPod into your car. That is it, ladies and gentlemen. This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware. And I'm Patrick Norton. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
Just so everybody knows, this may be the most interesting version of Twitch we've done. I've been up since 8 o'clock yesterday.
Dude.
We drove 15 hours straight through from Cincinnati, Ohio to Dallas, Texas.
Nice.
At least and then when we got here, it's been nonstop, checking that all of our prizes were here, checking what stage we were going to be on, meeting with people, figuring out when we were going to exchange things. We got this giant, this room is enormous that we have. I don't know if I can, there's Alan. Hi, everybody. There's
Alan!
Like this enormous room.
Take Alan to get barbecue tonight. It'll be good for both of you.
And so this room is for seven people.
You're kidding me.
No, and it was it cost me $160. So this was
they
well
say
worth it.
Everything's bigger in Texas,
and they are lying.
That's not your hotel room, is it? No, it's your work room.
No,
right?
this is like the conference room,
the
at
green room,
the convention center where QuakeCon is going on. But it was just like last second I asked, it's like, hey, we'd love to have a place where like all my team can meet and all that kind of things, and they said, well, here, have this. The only expensive part is obviously the internet, which I told you about before, and. If you want drinks, that's like $5 for a can of soda, and a granola bar is $4. So instead, I went to Sam's and bought boxes of Nutri-Grains and crackers and animal crackers. And
somebody was telling
like
me they were at a venue where they brought in some of their own food, and that is apparently a no-no that's specified in four-point type on their contract, and they tried to make them. They basically tried to throw out their food. Apparently, it devolved rather rapidly.
Oh, yeah, we don't want to do that.
Like, oh, man.
4 pounds of animal crackers.
You say it like it's a bad thing. I just got a feedback loop with Ryan's voice looped over itself at this end at a higher volume. That
really?
Was seriously trippy.
Is it happening now?
Is it happening now?
That did it.
Okay, that is the weirdest thing ever. He gets a feedback loop when I mute him. Yeah.
That's not supposed to happen.
It's because the universe doesn't want me silenced, Chad.